here he is, the man who preferred death to the tortures of the chain gang. His was the most sensational escape in chain gang history. Crawling through the thick brush, bloodhounds at his heels, hiding in swamps, he outwitted his pursuers at every turn. This man has lived 1,000 lives in one. A hunted thing on earth.
I'll learn you to sit up and hold on to this. Come on, get up.
I was just wiping the sweat off my face.
But you got it knocked off.
Why don't you play the game square?
You'll be sorry you said that.
Fellas, it's about time you called quits. You've been pulling a bluff on me, and I've been fool enough and coward enough to fall for it.
Oh, you filthy, good-for-nothing convict. A bluff, eh? You'll see. You'll see.
What's that doing?
Give me the police station. Jim, why haven't you come before?
I couldn't. I was afraid to.
You could have written. It's been almost a year since you escaped.
But I haven't escaped. They're still after me. They'll always be after me. No friends, no rest, no peace.
Oh, Jim.
Keep moving. That's all that's left for me.
Welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about the 1932 social drama, the classic, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, starring Paul Muni, is our pal from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog, Martin Gray. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Rob. Thank you for having me. It's a lovely film, and it's good to be talking to you about it.
Absolutely. This is your first time on the show. I'm really excited. This was something that you specifically mentioned that you wanted to talk about, and I had seen this movie years ago, and the thing that I remember about it specifically, and we'll get to it in more detail later on, is the ending. This movie has one of the great endings in all of cinema, and I think that's why it's part of the reason it's so fondly remembered. On side of the fact, it's just a great film. Basically, the plot is such, it's wrongly convicted James Allen, played by Paul Muni, serves in the intolerable conditions of a southern chain gang, which later comes back to haunt him. And of course, there's more details to it than that, and we'll get into it. But this film was based on a book by a real guy, Robert E. Burns, who wrote a book, I Am a Fugitive from a Georgia Chain Gang. And at the time of this film's release, this guy, Robert Burns, was on the lam from the law. He was literally running from the law. He had found his way out of Georgia, out of the chain gang. He'd made his way to New Jersey. And he was basically, I guess, hiding out there when the film was released, which is just sort of amazing. But it was a big expose about, you know, chain gangs, about what we were doing to prisoners under the sort of rubric of rehabilitation. And it really caused the scandal. The film was highly controversial. Warner Brothers took a lot of heat for it, but they thought this was an important thing. And it ended up changing the way we do chain gangs. I mean, basically got rid of them following this film. I mean, it really had a huge impact, and it's a remarkable film. Now, Martin, why did you want to, like, what's your history with this movie? Why did you want to talk about it?
Well, I first saw it when I was a little kid on the BBC. I used to watch short old films on Saturday afternoons, ancient black and white films, and it just really rocked me when I saw it for the first time when I was about 10 years old, especially, as you say, due to the ending, which we may or may not reveal. and again, I studied it years later at college. But, I mean, I like the film because it's a snapshot of a time and a place. And, you know, one I'm extremely glad I never experienced. It's a visceral human story of an ordinary man with dreams, you know, a guy you can root for, as he's blown by the fate to the place where we last see him. And the direction, the acting, the understated score just grabs me. And gotta admit, Rob, I shed a tear every time out.
Yeah, you have such sympathy for Paul Muni in this role. I mean, he's the setup is he is a World War I veteran, and he comes back from the war. But of course, he has some issues dealing with life on the in the real world when he's back. Of course, we now know that as post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's a thing that everyone knows about now. But back then, if you're going to go back to that George Carlin routine, it was called shell shock. But no one really diagnosed it. It was just sort of like, come on, just pull yourself together. And then that happens in the film, basically. I think his father is sort of like, just basically, come on, get a job, go back. And he can't adjust. He can't just go back to his normal life. And so he's restless. He has trouble connecting with people. And, this movie is about, takes that real issue, because that was a real thing. For people that, don't necessarily know about much about American history or have forgotten this, we really did a disservice to our World War I veterans. At one point, they were, massively out of work. Like, the World War I veterans were out of work, and they were very restless. And there was a protest on the grounds in Washington, D.C. of World War I veterans who camped out because they were so poor, and they demanded something from President Herbert Hoover to fix this, and he was sort of indifferent. And if you can believe it now, it seems completely nothing would happen like that nowadays. He actually ordered the army to move against 8,000 vets who were camped out and basically assaulted them to get them out of there from, to break up their protest. And these were World War I veterans.
That is just incredible and shameful. And it's interesting, and it was, with this being one of Warner's social realism dramas. What was it? It was in the next year, wasn't it? We had Gold Diggers of 1933, in which we had the big production number, Remember My Forgotten Man.
Forgotten Man, yeah.
Yeah, really powerful, dark number for, what you might expect to be, a nice light backstage musical. But of course, that was all about Koreans, scrabbling for money, doing anything they could to get the next meal. And, when you have them going, remember my forgotten man, you put a gun into his hand. I'm sorry about that. But it's just, it's really reflected in the story of Jim Allen here, because he starts out, he comes back from the war, as you say, with some post-traumatic stress syndrome. His dreams, his desires have changed. He was expected to stay in the office of the factory, when in fact he now wanted to be an engineer because he'd been in the engineering corps. And bit by bit, he's just broken down across the film. His ideals go, and it's just so tragic. And I think probably was reflecting on what was happening to so many people at the time. In fact, it was. You're telling me it was, and the history says it was.
Yeah, it's really is one of the more shameful moments in our American history. And ironically enough, the army that led this invasion against the veterans was led by Douglas MacArthur. Before he became MacArthur, became the famous one. But that's something that really did happen, and this movie reflects that. So anyway, James Allen, again, is played by Paul Muni. After he leaves, he wants to become an engineer. His family doesn't really support him in that. They said they want him to work in this office shop. He ended up wandering around. He sinks into poverty, and then he gets caught up in a robbery, which he didn't mean to. He ends up getting caught up with a guy who was a ne'er-do-well, and he ends up getting sentenced to 10 years on this Southern chain gang. And these scenes are really difficult to watch, as he is just, there's scenes of them all out in the hot sun, breaking up rocks with the pickaxe and stuff. And, you see fellow prisoners falling over dead or falling over out of heat prostration, and, the guards just basically kick them to get up. It's really is a brutal life for these guys, and some of them try and escape, and then they get shot when they're trying to escape, and they really are they're just turned into slaves. And yeah. It's really uncomfortable to watch all these guys go through this.
It is. It's such strong stuff. I mean, the first time I ever watched this film, I didn't notice it. One of the moments of sort of, slightly less grimness in the prison scenes, when the guy Barney gets freed from prison, and everyone's watching, going good luck, and he goes off out of the prison sitting on a coffin on a cart. But to the left of the shot, in the prison yard, there's a guy basically being crucified.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, there's this film was directed by Mervyn LeRoy, who had, you know, one of the great Hollywood careers, and he apparently had a tough time getting along with Paul Muni, I guess, but they seem to work together quite well because, I mean, he gets a great performance out of Muni. Muni played Scarface the same year another movie, which is, you know, amazing. That's two classic films done back to back. But the visuals here are really beautiful. I mean, Warner Brothers had a reputation in the 30s for being very grim and gritty, and the visuals here are really compelling. There's a long tracking shot where it goes over a bunch of the prisoners, and off on the soundtrack you hear like just this endless whipping of this guy just getting whipped over and over again, and it sounds like they're really whipping something just off camera because it doesn't sound foleyed in. It sounds like, no, there's really somebody getting hit because it just sounds realistic, and you watch all the prisoners reacting as they're hearing this guy like, as the, you know, you just hear the whip come down.
Oh, and, really? Does this? I mean, it's positively Hitchcockian when you're having the whipping scene in the prison and you just see the shadows, and as he says, it's all in the faces of the men and the sound. It's like, you know, like the psycho shower scene. It's all in your head. You know, you're imagining it because of the clever directorial choices and the shooting, the camera work. It's just a gorgeous film to look at, but, you know, hard to look at, gorgeous yet brutal.
Yeah. Alan escapes the chain gang in a great scene. There's this, oh man, it's so uncomfortable. There's this part where he's literally trying to just force the leg iron off of his foot, and he's pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, and you feel like he's gonna break his ankle
because
he's just trying to just squeeze it out. Yeah, he just keeps trying, and you're like, it's not gonna work, buddy. Your foot is too big, but he just keeps pressing it. That's really, that's awful to watch. And it's funny because one of his fellow chain gang members distracts the guard for him.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He knows that Alan is going to escape, so he starts talking to the guard, and he's like, hey, basically, you know, sort of look over here while Alan escapes. So he does escape. He makes his way to Chicago, and then he becomes a success in the construction business. He then gets involved with the propriety of his boarding house, a woman named Marie, played by Glenda Farrell, who actually I've mentioned on the show before. She was in the movie Susan Slept Here, which I talked about with Stephen Thompson. She discovers his secret that he's a escaped prisoner and blackmails him into an unhappy marriage. So this poor guy just cannot get a break.
She's a bit of a slattern, it seems.
Yes.
Apparently, in real life, the real woman that Robert Burns married, she wasn't that. She was nothing. You know, there was no evidence that she was anything like that. But they just obviously made it look darker in the film to make him look more like a paragon of virtue. You know,
yeah.
Beset at every turn.
Yeah. He then meets and falls in love with another woman named Helen, played by Helen Vincent. And then when he asks Marie for a divorce, she betrays him to the authorities. He gets offered a pardon if he will turn himself in. He accepts, only to find out that the whole thing was just basically a sham. And then he has to escape once again. And then we get into the third act of the film where he goes on the lam. And there's a series of montages where he is just living as a hobo. By his wits and having to, you know, borrow, beg, and steal to survive. And the film ends with, and again, you know, Martin and I discussed this about whether we should get into the details of this ending because, you know, if you want to see this film and you should see it, I don't necessarily want to ruin the ending, but the ending is so powerful that I would feel weird about not talking about it. So let me just give anybody a warning. If you don't want to know the ending, stop listening to this and come back later. So I'm going to give you a couple of seconds. And then Martin and I are going to come back because I do want to talk about the final scene. And so finally, it ends with Helen's walking around and she hears this guy call her name. And it's Alan. And he looks awful. He's bone thin. His clothes are disheveled. His hair is all messed up. And she asks him, can't you tell me where you're going? Will you write? Do you need any money? And he shakes his head and his answer and he backs away. And he starts backing away from her. And the camera pans and follows him. As the shadows get darker and darker, and we hear Helen, we don't see her, but we see him, and we hear her say, but you must, Jim, how do you live? And as the shadows almost completely envelop James, he just says, I steal, and the film goes to black. And all we hear is his footsteps. And that's the end of the film. And it is, I remember watching this film 10 to 15 years ago, and was just so startled that that was the end of this movie. It is so bleak, so dark, so effective that I was simply stunned. And I still am. I watched it again for this recording. And again, it is one of the great endings. And it is so impressive they managed to get that put across in a 1932 movie.
Yeah, that's such a dark ending. And it seems, according to director Mervyn LeRoy in his autobiography, that the darkness of the ending, the physical darkness of the scene, came because a fuse went out on set and the lights were blown. And he decided to keep that all enveloping darkness for the scene because it was so effective. But according to the film historian Rick Jewell, that was always in the script. It was just, you know, a matter of Mervyn LeRoy giving us a little bit of a good legend there.
Yeah, it's always good to print the legend if you can. I mean, however it came about, it really is an amazing ending, and it's you know, it's the perfect ending to this film. It doesn't give you any sort of nice resolution. I mean, this is just a problem. This guy's life has been ruined by the unfair system, and that's it. There's not going to be any hope for this particular guy, and that's the message that the movie leaves you with. Now, luckily, things turned out a little bit better for the real guy, because he ended up being in custody in New Jersey, but Georgia wanted him back, and New Jersey would not extradite him. So I was very proud of my home state that they refused to extradite him. New Jersey represent, and then eventually he got freed because they realized that he was wrongly convicted, and the whole film ended up convincing people to question the legitimacy of the United States legal system, and chain gang prisoners were freed in a lot of cases. And this did not sit well in Georgia, as you might imagine. Apparently, Georgia chain gang warden J. Harold Hardy was made into a character in the film, sued Warner Brothers for displaying vicious, brutal, and false attacks against him in the film. He lost that suit, but there was also something else too, where the studio head, Warner Brothers studio head, Jack Warner and Mervyn LeRoy were told, should they ever find themselves in Georgia, they would be treated to a dose of the social evil that they so roundly denounced.
Blimey, good Lord.
Yeah, so back then, you could just threaten the head of a movie studio with violence because they put something in a movie you didn't like, even though Warner Brothers went out of its way to take Georgia out of the title. Because in the book, he mentions Georgia, but there is no mention of Georgia in this movie at all.
There isn't, but in the montage sequence where he's coming down the map and he's superimposed on the map traveling down the railway line, it goes down from Kentucky and I think to Tennessee, and I think Georgia's the next one down. So he's moving out of the screen towards it. You think, if you know your geography, which I think would be then hitting Georgia, but yes, they did. They didn't want the film studios to be sort of boycotted or whatever by Georgia in the future because of one film.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you do. Yeah, they lead you with the suggestion that, yeah, that's where he is. He's in Georgia, but they don't actually say it. So they were kind of getting around that. It's interesting, like I mentioned earlier, apparently that Paul Muni and Mervyn LeRoy did not get along terribly well, but I think they must have respected one another, because I found this factoid on IMDb that there were only two people at Paul Muni's funeral, and one of them was Mervyn LeRoy.
That's so sad. Not that he was there, but just two people. I never knew that.
Yeah. I mean, he lived a pretty decent life, and he had a decent career, so I'm not sure exactly, you know, what that was all about. Apparently, James Cagney and Spencer Tracy were both considered for the part. Now, that's pretty understandable, because they were both – Cagney especially was a Warner Brothers guy, and you could see them playing this part. But Muni works well with his frame. Like, Muni was skinny, and then he got even skinnier.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it works well with that. I think Spencer Tracy kind of had that bullish shape, and Muni really looks undernourished throughout the film. He looks very pale and sickly, and I think that really helps to the realism of it. He looks like somebody who has not been eating a lot.
Yeah, and I think someone like Spencer Tracy, I don't think I would have believed him in the part quite so much, because I'm just so used to seeing Spencer Tracy as, you know, sort of super cocky, confident guy. Where, you know, a world beater. Whereas, whereas, like, things in the scene, for example, when James Allen meets Helen for the first time at the social dinner in Chicago or wherever, and you know, when she's asked him what he does and about building bridges, just the melancholy in his face and his voice, and he was so brilliant. You know?
Yeah, there's a terrific scene where Allen goes in to get a haircut. And while he's sitting there, a cop comes in to get a shave. And, of course, the cop doesn't know that Alan is a fugitive. But he knows, you know, so he's standing there and he doesn't want to he wasn't drawing attention to himself. So he's sitting there and the cop is just kind of talking about nothing really. And they keep getting closer and closer on Paul Muni's face. And he's just getting more and more like, you know, he wants to run out as fast as he can, but he also knows, you know, I can't do that either. That's a terrifically tense scene.
It is, yeah. And the barber says, how was it? Close enough? And he goes, plenty.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. It's got a great laugh, too, yeah.
Yeah, and the irony is that the policeman is sitting reading a magazine called Liberty.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just so clever.
And there's something else, too, that they mentioned to sneak in. Not sneak in, actually. It's right there. Is that there is a scene where Alan gets visited by a prostitute. And, like, they don't, like, hide it or shame it. You know what I mean? It's not like they're like, oh, this is the wrong. How dare he do that? Like, the scene just ends with her talking about, you know, she says, don't worry. She says something like, don't worry, pal. You're among friends, or you've got friends here. And you really get the sense that, you know, they're going to have relations as the screen goes dark, which is sort of amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Like,
they weren't allowed to show that stuff back then.
Yeah, because it was I think it was 2 years into the Hays Code came in, I think, 1930. Yes.
Yeah.
I believe. And then, yeah, and I mean, the lust's conveyed by the fact, you know, the camera pans, well, the motivated camera shot. You see his eyes and he's looking down her body, and the camera moves right down her body to her ankles, and, you know, and that also gets the idea, I think, well, to me, that, you know, he's, you know, it ends on her ankles, and you think that the chains that he's had chopped off his own ankles. But, it's so close to the edge. Then later on, when he gets together with Marie for the first time, and, you know, it becomes obvious that, you know, that they're having sex and she's trying to blackmail him into marriage. And he's going, he's paraphrasing, but he says, you know, it was all, I never loved you, it's just, and ... I think fooling around or something, he says. And just the implication that, you know, they're just having sex, recreational sex, and it means nothing else. Quite strong for the time, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It really is. I mean, I'm guessing that they kind of got this through because it was considered sort of like a message picture and an important movie. And
yeah.
I think those things got away with stuff a little more. But still, it really is remarkable. And it makes the film feel very vital, like very alive, very still present, even though we don't luckily have chain gangs anymore. But it doesn't... I mean, for as sort of, you know, clearly as old as it is, I mean, this is a just barely into the sound era type film. And it has these title cards that open up that very much like a silent film where
yeah.
It shows all the characters and has their names and stuff like that. It feels still to me very fresh. I mean, part of it is that it's short. It's only about 90 minutes, but it feels very vital and very alive and, you know, again, very humane. And, you know, you're sort of like, wow, good on you, Warner Brothers. You really took it in the teeth. You know, in 1932, that was pretty gutsy. And, you know, I think maybe it was on some level, again, a repudiation of what was going on with the government. I mean, you know, it was during the Depression. Herbert Hoover was desperately unpopular. And so this, you know, this might have been the kind of Warner Brothers has wanted to, you know, strike a blow for what they thought was the right thing to do. And Warner Brothers was one of those studios that was kind of very socially conscious. And this is one of those films that created that reputation.
It was, and indeed. It was a big hit. And, you know, you look again to the ending. And if nowadays they were making that the film and they tested that ending, that ending would have been thrown right out as a downer that people wouldn't come to see. But people went to see the film because it must have been just chiming with what they were feeling.
Yeah, yeah. And the one last thing I do want to mention about the ending, and I mentioned this about the scene with the whipping, is that when in the final scene where we're following Alan as he walks away, you can hear Helen calling out to him. But again, she's clearly really there because you can tell the audio has not been dropped in with a Foley. Like, and so you're really getting that feeling of distance between the two of them because you can hear her talk to him, but it's got that real sound of what it sounds like when someone far away is trying to talk to you. So it's utterly real. It's an utterly real scene. And as I said, it just remains one of the most powerful movie endings I have ever seen. And again, Muni, the film ends on Muni's face. It's just perfect. Now I kind of, having seen this film, I now kind of get the reference on MASH when there was an episode where Hawkeye talks about being a kid. And he's like, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was always the president and Paul Muni played everybody. And you know, I never really got that because I was like, I was aware who Paul Muni was, but then I've seen some of his career. He went on to play all these famous people, played Louis Pasteur. He won an Oscar for that. And he had a, you know, really tremendous career. He was one of the big 30s actors, but I get it now. Like, I get how so omnipresent Paul Muni seemed, because again, any guy that can play this and then Scarface in the same year, that's a guy really working on all thrusters.
Absolutely, and I think on the playing everybody, you know, I think he did play the historical figures in about two other films apart from Louis Pasteur, and it seems that, you know, he was the go-to guy for that.
Yeah, it was a tremendous, it's a tremendous, tremendous performance. The film got nominated for a couple of Oscars. It didn't win anything, but it really didn't matter. It was, as Martin said, it was a big hit, and it affected social change. It absolutely affected social change, and that's just an amazing legacy for a film like this. And I said, we hardly recommend anybody watch it. Go back and find it. It is highly entertaining. It is a downer. There's no doubt about it. But you also realize that, you know, everybody's, you know, the real guy's life was better after the film, and this film made lives better for certain people. And so that's kind of a nice thing to know, even if the film itself is pretty unrelenting.
It really is worthwhile. So were there any bits of the film that you didn't think worked, Rob?
I don't really think any of it didn't work, really. I thought all of it was really, again, it's short. It's only like 93 minutes, so yeah. It zips by very fast. I really thought there really wasn't any part of it that I didn't think worked. I thought, you know, again, Muni is so good in it. Maybe some of the comedy is a little broad at times, but I think
that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. The drunk guy, the suitor that Marie was fooling around with, it was like he was in a different movie.
Yeah, some of the supporting characters are a little broad, and it feels a little like vaudeville-y. But I think that was just sort of the humor at the time. I mean, it reminds me of like the comedic beats they would put in horror movies, you know, where it was like all this, you know, like all this Grand Guignol stuff, and then all of a sudden you have a guy like, "Hello there," you know, and you're like, "What? Okay." But that's pretty minor. That stuff is pretty minor.
Yeah, there was one line that Helen says, and I wasn't sure whether it's – well, I'll give you the line first where I think she's gone out for a drive with Jim after they've just met, and, you know, he's just talking about their lives, and she goes, "There are no musts in my life. I'm free, white, and 21. And I ran that back to check, and I'm thinking, is that social commentary or tinny-eyed racism? Strange.
Yeah, that's a weird. There's a movie called that, Free, White, and 21.
Really?
Well, yeah, that was a phrase back then. Yeah.
All right. Good Lord.
I'm pretty sure we heard that at the Republican convention this week. Oh, but
yeah, that sounds about right. Indeed.
Yeah, it does. But yeah, no, I really think this is a. You know, there really wasn't much of this movie that I didn't like. I get to that ending. I just, again, we're kind of going over and over and over again. We should probably wrap up here, but it's just, you're so impressed that they pulled it off, that they stuck the landing, and that they would end this film on such a way that it just leaves you just like sort of shaken. You're just like, wow, that's the, and also part of the ending is the result of the times and of how they made films is that, you know, of course, older films, they maybe have a title card that says the end.
Yes.
And maybe you'll get a card with the actors, but then that's it. The movie's over. There isn't 7 minutes of credits. And that makes, when you have a stark ending like that, it makes it all the more stark that the movie is literally over 30 seconds after that scene. Nowadays, if that movie, you know, if they made it now, that scene would end, and then you'd have 9-10 minutes with a, you know, the gaffer and the best boy and the, you know, all that stuff. And I think that would dilute the ending a little, but this doesn't. I mean, it's like he just goes, "I steal," and then 30 seconds later, the movie's over. You're done. And to me, it's that much more of a gut punch. So yeah, it's a terrific film. I think it's a really important film. It's one of the great Warner Brothers early social dramas, and we really recommend it to anybody that enjoys just good filmmaking and really solid storytelling, and especially if you like a film that has sort of real world implications. It's really terrific, and I appreciate Martin asking me to watch it again because it really is great. So Martin, thank you so much for doing the show, man. I was great to talk to you. For anybody paying attention, anybody who's a podcaster knows the difficulties with Skype, and Martin and I have had a lot of Skype problems in this episode, but we've muscled through it, and I hope everybody was able to enjoy this episode despite all the problems I'm going to have to edit around as I'm saying this. But Martin, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. And where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I do my weekly comic review blog, Too Dangerous for a Girl, and the title, I swear, is ironic, based on a Legion of Superheroes reference. I'm not a big old sexist, well. And that can be found at dangermart.blogspot.co.uk, or just Google Too Dangerous for a Girl. And if anyone wants to follow me on Twitter, I am @MartGray, MartGray.
Awesome, awesome. Again, Martin, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. It was great to have a chance to talk to you. Normally, I've heard your voice and you've heard mine, but we've never actually talked back and forth, so it was really great. So if anybody wants to follow this show, you can go to Twitter, and we're at Film and Water Pod, or you can just follow the show on the filmandwaterpodcast.com and leave a comment there, or send us a message via the contact form. So again, thanks everybody for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
I don't know if he deserves a bit of sympathy. Forget your sympathy. It's all right with me. I was satisfied to drift along from day to day till they came and took my man away. Remember my forgotten man? You put a rifle in his hand. You sent him far away. You shouted, hip hooray. But look at him today. Remember my forgotten man. You had him cultivate the land. He walked behind a plow. The sweat fell from his brow. But look at him right now. And once he used to love me. I was happy then. He used to take care of me. Won't you bring him back again? 'Cause ever since the world began, a woman's got to have a man. Forgetting him, you see, means you're forgetting me. Like my forgotten man.